What happened? Now, it is my job. That used to be my job. My job is I used to be an economist, a Washington economist type, and they'd give me big piles of numbers and I would make. He said, so he can't say on the other hand, you know? And it's true. It's true. Harry did say that. What do you need? What do you need? We're good? Okay. All right. So, I do not know, but I came up, I did some research about it. Now, there's some speculations of things that I heard. First thing is, it may simply be Windows 9, except it's Windows 9 expressed in the base 9 number system. If you laughed at that, you're a math geek, just like me. My people, the big problem is it would fail in the German market. It would be Windows 9! And so, I blame the Germans.
Know them all. It's a city. It's not a. It's a city. It's a very small city.
You really think we Americans are that dumb, don't you? They just say that because Americans don't leave America, and you know why? Because it's such an awesome place. It's the most awesomest place you could possibly imagine. You can't stand how awesome America is, and it's going to be even more awesome. But anyway, so.
What about Windows 10 now?
Windows 10. They have to do your William Shatner imitation. It's a must-break curse of even-numbered Windows. You know, the odd numbers were the good ones. I think also the fact that the start menu, which they kind of fixed, there's no folders. So this would distract Gartner from noticing that. There is a blog, this is not a lie, there's a blog that somebody posted that said that he used to work on the Java team and that the Java installer would not accept any Windowses with a 9 in it because of Windows 95 and 98. It's a lie, but it's a great story. It turns out, though, I figured it out. This is the thing. Sometimes we have to break the paradigm. You're thinking Windows goes from Windows 6 to 7 to 8, right? You're thinking it's an arithmetic progression of the numbers for Windows. Does that make it? Are you with me? Yes? It turns out Windows is so awesome, it grows exponentially. I used to do this for a living. I took the numbers, and if you watch, Vista was Windows 6, and that rounds to 6. Windows 7 is actually Windows 6 times 1.17. So it's actually 7.02, which rounds to 7. Windows 8 is 17% more of that, which is 8.2, which rounds to 8. The next one, 70% more, is 9.6097, which rounds to 10.
How many people think
that? All right. So how many have Windows 10 deployed? And don't tell me you have 5 machines in the lab. Cool. Has anybody done any of the bumps, like from 1507 to 1511, we have the new ones. The next 3 are called Redstone. I don't know why. I do know it's a missile launching platform. Okay. So, questions? Please go up to the mics, and unless any of you guys want to make an opening statement or something.
I don't introduce ourselves,
sir.
We could introduce ourselves.
That's a great idea. Let's do that. Please.
Starting with
what are we doing
here?
Who are you?
Oh, who am I?
Hi, who are you?
Hi, I'm Heike. I'm a product manager in the Windows
Ladies
team,
first.
And I own
Germany's.
Windows Defender ATP, Windows Defender anti-malware, and the entire networking stack.
My name is Dave Weston. I'm an engineering manager in the security group in Windows.
My name is Augusto Valdez. I'm in the product marketing team for Windows, and I focus on Windows Pro.
Mike Niehaus, also on the Windows marketing team. Responsible for deployment, servicing, provisioning.
I'm Jason Lesnick. I'm on the product marketing team as well. I focus on manageability, business value, and privacy.
And I'm Alan Mears, and I work on Windows 10 Mobile. Still exists, by the way.
And you're in marketing?
Oh, no, I'm not in marketing.
That's like my awesome Windows phone. You do that? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Anybody else got a Windows? I didn't think so. We get a lot of abuse, us Windows phone owners, but you know the market share is slowly coming up. We are creeping up on other. All right. So anybody want to go stand by a mic, ask a question? Is that you standing by a mic, sir? Or did you just get here?
Yes, it is me.
Hi.
Hello.
I thought maybe you just came in the room, you didn't know whether you had to stand by the mic or not.
I've done that a couple times, actually. So my question is, with Windows 10, we noticed the loss of the Windows Easy Transfer utility, and I was curious why.
That's a good question.
We really liked it. And you can drag the Windows 8.1.1 over to Windows 10, and it still works.
I have a theory. USMT got a lot better. And I know it's a pain in the neck, and it looks like big, complicated lines, but it really gets more done. And if you're doing it for your dad, yeah, then Easy Transfer's nice. But if you're doing it for anything else, then, I mean, really, I think USMT's worth looking at.
Well, wasn't the Easy Transfer utility just a front end for the USMT?
Was it?
It's the same engine. Yeah.
Is it?
So behind the scenes,
yeah, it was just a really user-friendly version
Easy
of it.
Transfer and USMT all use the same engine. So it was just a decision to deprecate that particular wizard-driven interface.
Do I get a prize for hard questions? I could really use a Surface.
You can come up here and sit with us.
My boss is in the crowd, so he's going to get a picture of this.
Over there.
He's coming.
He's coming. He's coming.
Okay. There we go. All right, then.
Love it.
Thanks. I'm going to tone my sarcasm down.
So, is it on?
Yeah.
So why can't we restore or roam the start screen? We can back it up. There's a PowerShell commandlet for this, but we can't restore it, and we can't roam it. Why?
We used to be able to.
Yeah.
It was like that in Windows 8, and I think in 8.1 as well, but it was removed in Windows 10. It wasn't used very much, and for those that did use it, they found it a little confusing, so it was scaled back at that point. It worked really well for modern apps. It just doesn't work well for desktop applications, and most people were more interested in desktop applications, so something we can revisit later, but for right now, it's not enabled.
And there are no dirty tricks to do it anyways?
No simple tricks, certainly.
This is on branding. The login screen and lock screen, the changing the background seems to be harder and harder as Windows versions go up. So.
There's actually a mathematical formula for that. Can you be a little bit more specific?
XP, it was as easy as just replacing a BMP file or a JPEG, and it was on the lock screen and in the login screen.
Centrally managing it, you mean?
Central, yeah.
Yeah.
Windows 7, it was in the OOBE web. I forget what folder it was. And
web sounds good. Something.
I
web.
Forget what it, I forget what the exact place was, but in Windows 10, those old tricks don't work anymore, and we're kind of forced to just have a color, or which doesn't even really work half the time. So
there's the central manageability of the lock screen is an enterprise and education SKU feature. Some of the more deeper user experience things moving away from the consumer side that's in like consumer, the home and the pro SKU are an enterprise. I'm not sure whether that's the issue. I know that you can configure the lock screen and the home screen and things like that with the wallpaper. I'm not sure whether that's the issue that you're seeing. We could take it offline, but.
Okay.
What's your answer?
He was up on stage, wasn't he? You had your chance, dude.
But all the articles online, I can't find that setting.
It's hard to find.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, actually, there's an article now that says that that particular policy only works on enterprise and education.
Yeah.
I've read that one way too many times.
Over there.
Thanks. Has there been any thought into providing some more granular access to controlling the Action Center in Windows 10? From our experience so far in our deployment, we've got a few hundred users, and you can either turn it on or off. You can't control the individual items from the different sections. So it, certainly in the user interface, you can click on that button to say, hey, don't show me those messages before, but I don't have a way to control that from an enterprise perspective.
So you're talking about Action Center, not the Settings app.
Correct.
Quieting down certain apps from publishing into that?
Correct.
Okay. Nothing that I'm aware of, but that's great feedback that we can bring back for the planning process. Just out of curiosity, what kind of information would you not want to have up there?
So according to some of our security practices, the way I've got the firewall configured, I'm getting nasty messages from the firewall saying it's undesirable state. Okay. And so I can't seem to get rid of that. And unless I turn off the Action Center, you know, I don't want people thinking, oh, no, you guys don't know what you're doing. But no, it's supposed to be that way.
That's a help desk call. It's a confused help desk call.
Exactly.
Okay, that's a great feedback. We'll bring that back.
Thank you.
My question is, by default, connecting to open Wi-Fi hotspots is on, and wanting to know why under network settings that that's set to automatically allow those connections.
Why it's automatically, like why it's by default
yeah,
on?
Yeah, by default it's set to connect to open hotspots automatically, no matter if you know it or not. If it sees an open one, it will connect to it.
That's set by default, you can turn it off.
Right, but I'm saying, but you can turn it off, but why is that a setting that's on by default coming out of the box?
Because we want to make it easy for users to connect to Wi-Fi.
Consumers.
it's a consumer.
I get that. I'm just thinking from a security perspective, you have somebody who has an open hotspot that's there for nefarious purposes. That's the one that it sees. Then that person's hosed the minute they turn their computer on.
Yeah.
So just a thought, something for you guys to think about.
Yeah. That's
Thank good. You. Yeah, I'll take it back. So maybe in enterprise versions or something,
yeah,
we
could default.
Yeah.
Change it.
Yeah. Well, isn't it something you want to do in all the versions? Because the home edition isn't really run by expert users, and attaching. did I say that gently enough?
Who hired you?
And I really don't want grandma connecting to unsecured.
Oh yes, I want grandma, because otherwise she calls me, how can I connect to a network?
Oh, whoa.
If grandma knows PowerShell, she can turn it off.
Whoa. I think there's a way to solve the grandma problem. So how many of you have a tech support role, not only for your company, but your friends, your family, and everyone who lives in 30 miles from you? Okay, yeah. So,
Can I get some numbers and give them to my family?
This is the trick, okay? When your loved one says, what kind of computer should you get?
Uh-oh.
Tell him or her a Macintosh.
Oh, I knew he was going to say that.
No, and I do that because I don't know jack about Macs.
Again, who hired you?
She said, I'd like to be able to help you, honey, but I can't. Okay.
Are we paying you to do this, by the way?
Yes.
No. Non-blue badges don't get paid to speak here.
Is Apple paying you?
No. I make it Linux, just some operating system that you don't know. Geez, I wish I could help you, honey, but it's just Linux. Oh, it's just so complicated. But the penguin's so cute. Where are we? Which side here? Is it you? I think it's you.
I think it's me. unfortunately, my business is on Pro. What features are you planning to turn off and disable in Pro in the future?
All of the good ones.
That's what we think.
Yeah, so there was the, through, from Windows 8.1 on through the Threshold 2, there's been some changes to the manageability features. And what you're going to see over time is that there will be more scenarios that are for like the stronger management capabilities. If you take a look at what's in Home, which is obviously the consumer SKU, and then Pro, which is kind of the entry into the business with the consumer experience in there. And then what we're trying to do is focus more of the overlap with that type of experience with enterprise, kind of getting a little bit less obvious, less there. So we're shifting some of those management around like the consumer experience types of things into the enterprise to turn off. That being said, I think that some of the ways that things were changed or communicated was not optimal with this one. So, for example, the ability to disable things like tips and suggestions and things like that is only available in the enterprise and education SKU. However, in the pro SKU, we introduced a group policy setting so that you can turn off third-party related content and only have Microsoft or like Windows-specific stuff. And we need to do a better job of communicating that out. And we did not do that great of a job this first time.
Back to your question on the strategy and what we want to do with Pro, really, we have done a rationalization of how we want to position Pro versus Enterprise and how do we want to have offerings that are according to the different business requirements that a company has. You shouldn't expect that we're going to be deprecating many more new things on Pro in the future, but the more enterprise heavy type of capabilities are going to potentially come more in enterprise, on the enterprise SKU or in the enterprise edition, rather than on the Pro edition.
And do you guys expect that you're going to move people more into enterprise? Because it used to be you needed to buy five licenses, and there's some organizations smaller than that. But now you can do the enterprise
CSPs through E5, E3, etc.
Right. Is it was that the idea there? Was that if you've got a one or two person operation, they can still get enterprise? They
don't and all of those actually require Pro as a base foundational OS to actually move into those offerings that we're going to be continue to evolve through cloud services. So Pro is going to continue to be the main operating system that we will offer through business PCs targeting enterprise organizations, and then from there you can grow into whatever is the right cloud service running on top of Pro to enable the enterprise capabilities that your organization will need.
Over here.
Me again. Group policy preferences was introduced in the XP days, and it was really good at being able to target specific settings without having to create an additional GPOs, which would add additional load times. Haven't really seen much movement in adding new features and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Group policy preferences came out, I believe, in Windows 7 through an acquisition that we made at the same time that we had the advanced group policy management console. We're taking a look and rationalizing how we have kind of the existing management technologies and requirements, I guess, and scenarios from group policy, very deep management through like System Center Configuration Manager, and the lighter style management that's becoming more popular with mobile devices and cloud management through MDM. We don't have today a one-to-one mapping between what you can do with group policy and group policy preferences and MDM through the CSPs, the configuration service providers that Intune and AirWatch and everything else talks to. And I think it's a work in progress. It's trying to figure out, and we're trying to learn which group policy settings are very common, the ones that people want. How do we convert those into exposure through MDM so that you have the choice if you're going to be managing from an MDM product through the cloud, for example, or whether you're still doing like the deeper lockdown that would be appropriate for group policies to do. So like right now, we have flexibility, we've got the choice. It's not a one-for-one choice, and we're trying to evaluate how to do that, how far we go with MDM versus group policy is the really, really granular one. If you want that, you should use group policy.
So you're saying group policy preferences is sort of there as a legacy thing, and you're moving people more over to MDM for that type of stuff?
Over time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I'm not saying that group policy or GP preferences are dead or anything like that, but as we're looking, I think that we've got a lot covered with group policy and include preferences with that, and now we're seeing how to affect the management more from an MDM side too. And, if there's a gap in one end, we should identify what that gap is and then bring it over.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is there any chance at all we'll ever, I realize MDM's popular because Intune's doing well, but if we're talking about heavy machines, machines that are doing real laptops, not just mobile devices, something like desired state configuration? I mean, that has the kind of flexibility that he's asking for. With DSC, he could write his own stuff. I know it's for servers, but I've always wondered why we don't think about it. Because it works well in a non-domain world, mm-hmm. which we see more and more because of the cloud.
It's definitely something we should explore. We're not trying to not do something and say this is just not a scenario that we should cover. It's like we have it here. We want to make the MDM way. You know, a lot of folks are going more in that direction. We've got a blog right now that's out that's called the Path to Modern Management, I think is what it is, Modern Management with Windows. And we're actually in the process of updating that on TechNet. That kind of puts things into perspective with, you know, the deeper management, on-prem, domain join, corporate-owned devices that you're locked down versus the more, you know, less lockdown, more focus on user enablement, but still focusing on data and app protection through the cloud. So it's like, do I want the whole on-prem thing? Do I want completely in the cloud or somewhere in between? So we're rationalizing that. We have to talk more about it. And again, you know, the feedback is great about, hey, you know, I like the group policy preferences, the desired configuration. You know, we just, that's great feedback, and we'll kind of work more with you guys as customers to, you know, find out what those scenarios are and prioritize them.
Thanks. Over here, what do you got?
Hey, I have a question I asked already yesterday, but yesterday I didn't disclose that I'm a German journalist, so I'd like a quotable answer.
Well, thank you for doing that. Appreciate that.
The question is, why does Microsoft do in-place upgrades? Michael Niehaus will have heard this question. With the feature updates, and isn't exploring alternatives like Delta upgrades, because the current in-place upgrades still seem to be very problematic, especially when you're not managing your stuff with group policies, and coming from a country that has, let's say, trust issues with data, Germany. It's really seems like a tactic to reset privacy settings in Windows on every upgrade.
Did you get the question in that?
Was there a question in there?
Oh, the question is, why is the in-place upgrade the standard for the upgrade? Why don't you do Delta updates or something like that?
Yeah, so we kind of need to separate two things there. One is the process that's used to deploy feature updates, and the other is the kind of the packaging of the feature updates. The process that we use today is an in-place upgrade. That in-place upgrade is designed to be 100% perfect. We're not 100% perfect, so we continue to submit bugs to fix those types of issues. We want it to migrate 100% of the settings. So anything you see that's not getting migrated correctly, let us know. That should be a bug. Submit feedback through the feedback hub, contact your TAM, work with your account team, send us email, whatever it takes, we'll make sure that those issues are resolved. All of those settings, default applications, any preferences that you've set should be maintained through that upgrade process. We continue to fix bugs related to that. Each monthly update includes new fixes for those types of issues so that the upgrade process continues to get better over time with each fix that we apply. Now, on the packaging side, The main issue there is really more around the size of it. So how do we get from the 3.5 gig size to something smaller, which is the idea of doing a Delta. The challenge that we have is that there's only so much that we can do via a Delta, and we're working on that and looking to deliver something around that probably next year sometime. But we can only do the Delta to the point of what files haven't changed in each of the new feature updates to come out. If we look at the large number of developers that we have in our organization and the amount of time that they're working before each feature update comes out, most of the binaries inside of Windows are touched with each update, with each feature update that comes out. So our delta, the opportunity there are the things that aren't binaries. Bitmaps, sound files, really any type of graphic element, sometimes text, sometimes just random stuff that's part of the operating system, like fonts. They don't tend to change from release to release. So that stuff we can separate out, and we can then just apply the rest of the operating system. So we do think that we can reduce that size over time. We just don't think it's ever going to be just an update. it's always much more than that because we're replacing a significant portion of the operating system with the new functionality that we add in each feature update. That's why we target in-place upgrade as the cleanest way to do that. It's not to say it's the only way or the only way that we'll ever do it, but for right now, it's the easiest way for us to lay down a complete set of new features and then migrate all of the application's data and settings forward into that new OS release.
And you know, if you want more about the way the in-place upgrade works, I believe it was the 2014 Tech Ed, get on channel 9, and it's a great talk about, you know, bits by bits about, because you know, in-place upgrade, it's like swapping out the carpet without changing the furniture, you know.
Is this your talk?
No. Some really smart man from Microsoft talked about the whole process. It was great. I watched it several times.
And we actually repeated that session this year.
Oh, did you? Okay.
The session was done by a different program manager this time. Pallavi did the session this time around, but explaining how the upgrade process works and also how to troubleshoot it and all the types of things that we consider bugs that should be fixed.
Yeah, the original presentation was great. And the cool thing is when you look at it, you're like, damn. They should have done that 20 years ago, but you know, obviously, these things all, you know, kind of. The other thing too is that when Michael was talking about how you can push back with bugs and that sort of thing, I think one of the biggest things that came out is user voice, because you know, with Windows 7, I got to pay $500 to tell Microsoft they got bugs. With user voice, if you've not been there, go. It's very, very neat stuff.
It is used.
No, I can tell you. I mean, you guys are commenting all the time. It really feels like some of the best. You know, keeping us in the loop that we've had for a really long time.
Yeah, great. So. Okay, thank you.
Over here.
All right, first I'll put in a plug. Now here I should go to user voice, but for the GPP as well, we use it heavily, and we have configuration management from a different team that does package delivery, so SDCM is not really where we want to go for configuration control. But my question is, there's been lots of great talk about all the security in Windows 10 and all the great features if you have modern hardware with everything turned on to UEFI and TPM and yada, yada, yada. What about we upgrade in place, because that's the preferred method, of a 6-year-old laptop that has no TPM and no UEFI? What security benefits do we get from a upgrade to an old platform can we get from that?
Defender.
By chance, did you go to Chris Hallam's session this week?
No, but I can look that up.
Because he did a security overview session talking about that, basically showing you, here are the security features in Windows 7, here are the security features in Windows 10 that you get on legacy hardware, and then here are the security features that you get with modern hardware. So that's a good starting point, just to break down all the different features we have in the OS into
Chris
those
Hallam?
Categories.
Chris Hallam.
Hallam.
Yeah.
Okay. I did a session today, too, about hardening in Windows 10 and Ren teaming. And what I can say is 90% of the features I went over in that talk, which are substantial, are software-based. They're not; they don't require any hardware. So things like exploit mitigations, our anti-rot technology like Control Flow Guard, are now built in by default. We have increased sandboxing in Edge. We have kernel isolation in Edge, which gives you some flavors of some of the things that are in, say, Application Guard. So there's a substantial number of hardening practices that have come up. We've even integrated things that were previously in Emmet by default into the operating system. And so take a look at that, and I think you'll find even a 6-year-old laptop gets a substantial increase in protection.
Great, thank you.
Hi there.
Hey there, how you guys doing?
Good.
How are you?
Good. I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to ask you 1.5 things, really. One of them is an extension of the gentleman who was here a couple before me about Action Center. One of the things that we're challenged with, I work for a school system outside of D.C., and we're just challenged with trying to quiet what Windows 10 is usually trying to kind of notify. There's a lot of notifications that come along, whether it's apps or whether it's the system. So one comment I have moving forward, and then I'll ask a question, is what we found basically was disabling the Action Center did not get rid of all the pop-ups. And the reason why was because Security Center has its own channel into those pop-ups, like firewall and things like that. So we found that by going into Security Center and disabling all those desired pop-ups, we were able to get all of them to go away, but they weren't in one place. So it'd be nice if it was all in one place so that really you could quiet it so everything stays quiet. Okay, so that's my comment.
Thank you.
Second thing, maybe this is a question for Mike or others with SCCM. We had a unique experience recently where we ordered about 10,000 devices, and we had paid a vendor to go ahead and put our image on the devices for us to save us a little bit of time so we didn't have to image them with SCCM or whatever. And one of the things that we asked them to do to save us a little bit of time was to go ahead and boot them up that first time and let them run through SysPrep. Okay, but they didn't, we have a naming convention and we have all kinds of things about how we join them to the domain, et cetera. One of the things that I found challenging, and maybe I'm missing something, you can help me, I couldn't find a way with a task sequence to really easily name the computer, join the domain, and install the SCCM client. It seemed like once the image was on there and it had already rebooted in and gone through SysPrep, the setup windows and config manager step in the task sequences just basically wouldn't work. It would exit out an error every time. And so it would be nice if there were some steps in MDT, and maybe I'm missing them, but if there were just an ability to name the computer, join the domain, and install the SCCM client, and have them be kind of separate and be able to be broken out.
Yeah, the configuration manager implementation today assumes that when you want to do those things, you're mm-hmm. doing a bare metal deployment.
Right.
So they have a apply network settings, apply computer settings mm-hmm. step, and the setup config manager client step that are all designed to start off in Windows PE, where you can configure the OS before it boots the first time. To do that later, there are ways to do that, but they're just not built-in config manager actions.
Oh yeah, we wrote a script to do it.
Yeah, the other dependency in config manager is in order to run a config manager task sequence on a PC that's already running Windows, it has to be a config manager client already. So it's a chicken and egg problem in that case, where you need to put the config manager client on it to run the task sequence. You could do that with MDT, you could do that with provisioning packages to run a series of commands, but given what you're describing doing, you could do that with probably a 10-line PowerShell script too. It would be really easy to rename the computer, join it to Active Directory, and then either manually install the config manager client as part of that script, or just have your group policy configured to push the config manager client down automatically. So that particular piece, you're not going to, it's probably overkill to use a task sequence to try to do that much of it, because you're not talking about building out the entire computer, you're just talking about saving time from a few manual steps that you wouldn't want to do, like going into settings and changing the computer name and all that piece.
So what we ended up doing was we wanted it to be pretty easy for our folks and not have to give them USB keys or anything like that to run the PowerShell. We wrote a PowerShell script, a little more than 10 lines, but what we effectively did was we had them boot into Pixie, and then WinPE laid down some content onto the drive, and then we used a series of PowerShell with auto logon to be able to keep, you know, because what the challenge is that you can't rename a computer and join it to the domain if the computer name is already in existence in the domain. That, and we had already all these accounts pre-created, so we really had to do it in multiple steps. Rename the computer, reboot. Then join the domain with that computer name, then reboot. You know, so we did have some challenges, but I did it basically, I kind of think I did it the way you just described it. And we did it through Pixie, you know, so that it would be easy and our tech support folks could just boot and it would run through it, and it was easy to choose. So it'd be nice if there were some options maybe in the future to break out a few of those steps, because some can be done with Pixie. You can do some of those things.
I think you could save yourself a little more work and make your PowerShelling more powerful if you look into workflows, because those really multiply. I mean, they're great for that first setting up stuff, because you know, you can't run a script that reboots in the middle of it and things like that. Workflows solve all that problem. It's not that bad. There's a lot of really good stuff about it, so give that a look.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
Over here. Hi.
Hi. I hope it's allowed to have two questions. I hope I can make it short.
Two short ones.
Two short ones. Okay. So, in general, Mike already lined out very good the Windows as a service piece. And when we are in a current branch and we find out, let's assume there is an enterprise application, self-written or bought, doesn't matter, and in the next version it breaks. So you advised us to give us to give Microsoft feedback through the feedback tool, but this feedback is always unidirectional. You only can send it in, and you never get feedback back, okay, yeah, we found it out, and we will fix it in blah, blah, blah. So, but that's not acceptable by managers. When I tell my manager, hey, there is a bug, and we reported it to Microsoft, but I never get any answer back. It's acknowledged, we're working on it, and in CBB it's fixed. This yep. is what managers want to know. So in the past I learned, okay, there is a different way to do that, and that typically works when you have a premium support contract with Microsoft. So you can deal with right. your TAM, the TAM can contact the program management, etc., and you get something back. But a premium support contract is very expensive. So is there a standard affordable way for even smaller companies without having a expensive premier support contract?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we recognize the challenge today that when you submit feedback, it is a very large set of feedback that we get through that, and it's a mixture of commercial feedback and consumer feedback. So the small amount of commercial feedback can easily get lost in the noise of all the consumer feedback that we get. So we are working on creating a Windows Insider commercial program so that we can specifically tie feedback to organizations, potentially using Azure Active Directory accounts or something like that, so that we know here's the feedback that we're getting from these organizations and pay more attention to the enterprise feedback over some of the consumer noise that currently drowns it out. So that's one piece of it. The TAM certainly get the most direct feedback route today. If you have a problem and you need a resolution now, you really need to open a support case. If you have a Premier support agreement, your TAM helps you with that and guides you through the whole process. If you don't have a support agreement, you can still call Microsoft support. They're going to ask you for a credit card, but as long as it's a bug, they won't charge you. They'll actually say, yes, we acknowledge that's a bug. We're working on fixing it. They'll refund the amount that you would pay for that support case. So you've got options, but we know that we've got more work to do to make the insider feedback a lot more actionable, especially for commercial customers.
That's great.
One thing I'll add to that as well is there are places in Microsoft where we're experimenting with different paradigms there. For example, the Microsoft Edge bug tracker is actually public. So anybody can report an issue, and you can check the status of that issue at any time. So it's fully transparent. I don't know if that will transition across other parts of the company, but there are definitely different groups thinking about that problem and making it more collaborative.
That's great. Thank you. The second one, shortly, small, especially to Heike.
Oh.
Oh, yes.
I'm trying.
You have my email address. Just kidding. Go ahead.
Okay. It's regarding the Windows Defender ATP feature. And, whoa, I love it. But you send a lot of data towards Microsoft. And is there any possibility to limit that data or the location towards German cloud, for example? As you may know, that German customers don't like to store this type of sensitive data into a public Microsoft cloud.
Do you Germans have something to hide?
Actually, we don't have anything to hide. It's just the natural fear of National Security Agency.
So, I mean, you want to understand if you have a data breach on your network. So we need to collect all kind of events from the machine to actually really understand if there is a threat going on or not. So all the information that contains PII data is in your own separate Windows Defender ATP tenant. Only when we actually send data to the Microsoft cloud to do all our global analytics, all the data gets scrubbed and there's no personal identifier information in this data anymore at all. Right now, we have data centers with Windows Defender ATP in the US and in Europe. We are looking into expanding this into other markets or like in other countries. We need to see where it goes next. So maybe it goes to the Schwarzwald cloud or not, but it's not there yet.
Yeah, the other thing I'll add to that is we understand data sovereignty is a problem across the board. So whatever the solution is for Microsoft, whether that's for O365 or other cloud-based products, ATP will build on that. And I know that we are actively working on compliance solutions for the myriad of requirements across the globe. I don't know specifically about Germany, but I realize that's a big market, yeah. And I expect that we'll be pushing there quickly. Just to add what Heike says, even our own analysts cannot see any of the PII information. So I own the team that actually develops detections based on Defender ATP, and it's fully scrubbed. We only get metadata about the alerts, but you completely control that data.
Thank you.
That's great. Over here.
So I have a question. I already tried to get an answer by using Premier support, but the answer I got was not that that useful. So the problem is you announced a new service model regarding supporting new hardware. So when thinking of Intel chipsets, Intel CPUs, you currently support generation 6 and 7, so Skylake and Kaby Lake starting with Redstone release. So next generation, name it Coffee Lake or Cannon Lake or what's the next name, will not be supported by the 1607 release. It will be supported by the next release. So that's your official statement. That's no problem when thinking of CB or CBB because we are thinking about getting a new release next year. So before Intel ships out a new platform, there would be a new Windows release. But there is currently no solution how to deal with long-term servicing branch, because long-term servicing branch, I think the next release will be in 2019 maybe. So there's no official statement that we will get a new LTSB release earlier. And what to do in the year 2018? We have to plan now. If we use LTSB, so in some days LTSB 1607 gets out, that will support Skylake and Kaby Lake. But in the year 2018, there will be no more more recent LTSB release than the Redstone, and there will be no support for the upcoming Intel chipsets. And there is no possibility to buy actual hardware in the year 2018 being officially supported by LTSB.
Yeah, we're aware of the challenge. I mean, our official statement that we published is that support for new chipsets requires new Windows releases. That applies to CB and LTSB releases. So the LTSB 2016 release that will be out next week, as well as the CB release that we came out with in August, support Skylake and Kaby Lake. The next one, I believe, is Cannon Lake. It comes out next year. That will require a new Windows release for both CB and LTSB. As you point out, the next LTSB is not expected until 2019, so that would mean that new release won't support new hardware between now and then. We are aware that that's a potential challenge. We believe Intel will continue selling Skylake and Kaby Lake PCs through at least early 2018. We're not sure what happens beyond that, but we are discussing that both with Intel and within our own organization to figure out what the right answer to that is. We can't just say that, oh, okay, we'll go ahead and support Cannon Lake and later chipsets with LTSB because we haven't even seen them yet. We don't know what kind of changes they're going to require in the operating system. It used to be chipsets just required new drivers and off we go. But now chipsets require specific tuning of the OS to make it run with reasonable performance and battery life, so we can't just make a blanket statement on that yet. But certainly our written guidance so far is, yes, that's true. You need a new LTSB release to support new chipsets.
I understand these technical answer. So what I need is an official statement that Microsoft is aware of this and will provide a solution, either making updates for the existing LTSB or provide a new LTSB release, but not let the customer in the situation having no choice of buying new hardware in the year 2018.
I can tell you officially, we are aware of the situation.
Okay. And, but you cannot say that you will handle it.
We're still discussing it. Yeah, we don't know what the right answer is for that yet.
But there will be an answer which satisfies us.
Yeah, well, I mean, just so like what initial Skylake support policy satisfied everyone.
Yeah, but there are only two choices. Update the current or bring a new one. So what would be the third choice?
We've raised the issue to engineering. It is being discussed at the VP level. We'll see what comes from those discussions. Fortunately, we do have some time to work that out.
Okay,
recommend
thanks.
Continue to work with your account team, and they can work with us to make sure that you're up to date as things go.
Thank you.
Over here.
So the main question I have is it possible to configure Defender Advanced Threat Protection to go through a proxy? And
yes.
The corollary is, can you do the same thing with Windows telemetry the same way you can with Office telemetry? Is that documented anywhere?
So I didn't get the second question.
Oh, Windows telemetry. Can Windows telemetry be proxied?
That's in progress.
So the answer is no for now, but ATP, the answer is yes?
Yes.
Do you know where that's documented?
So on TechNet, we have everything documented, even the proxy settings, how you configure them. Okay. There's a TechNet note for Windows Defender ATP, how you onboard your clients, most common troubleshooting issues, and proxy issues actually in this.
I think I found the document TechNet you're talking about that says, hey, you need to basically whitelist these seven settings. Our machines don't have the ability to go around proxy, so we need, because all our machines go through a user-based authentication proxy, so we actually have to plug in like internet user and actually fake it going to a user proxy. We can't just whitelist the addresses. Is that possible? Do you understand what I said?
I don't know.
Take it offline.
Okay. Let's take it
we
offline.
We can take it offline. I know that from the Windows telemetry point of view, that was an issue in the past and we were addressing it. Honestly, I don't know whether that was addressed in the anniversary update or it'll come post that, but I know that they're working to address that. I think it was in Redstone, but
I'm not.
Yeah, I think Mark Andrea said it was
let's
soon.
Connect.
Yeah, yeah.
Hi. Back in the Windows 7 and Vista days, there was something called gadgets,
yeah.
I think, on the sidebar. And eventually, those things, I think, were removed because there were some serious security vulnerabilities. But, you know, it's the first thing I noticed when I, you know, boot up Win10, I see, you know, news and weather stuff popping up on the desktop and the Metro interface. So I guess my question is, what was the security vulnerability back in the old days? Because it kind of looks like it's doing the same thing in Windows 10.
I can take that. Completely different security model. So the gadget security model did not involve sandboxing. So when you were grabbing a gadget from the public gallery, you were essentially granting it full trust to the system. Windows Store apps are built from the ground up to have isolation and to be transparent and declarative about the things that they have access to. We also have a full scanning and onboarding security analysis policy for when developers submit apps to us. Those two particular apps you're talking about are actually Microsoft developed, so it's Microsoft owned code. What I would say is even if something could be exploited, if there were a security issue, it's fully contained within our sandbox and isolation model, and so the risk to the user is extremely minimal, even in the rare case that it could be exploited.
And even in a corporate environment, I mean,
yeah,
I guess I'd be, you know, concerned that there's some sort of open API to create those perhaps unwanted network connections.
Open API from which?
Maybe I'll rephrase my question. The thing on Windows 10 that, you know, looks at MSNBC or CNN, whatever it is, would you characterize it more as a special app rather than the next generation of a gadget?
Yeah, I would characterize it as a UWP or Universal Windows app, and all of the things it has access to and does are declarative, and then you can check in the app properties. And that particular app is built by Microsoft. If there were any security issues, we would issue an update immediately and service it just like any other inbox component.
All right.
Seriously, take a minute and Google Bing modern app sandbox. There's some really interesting stuff. Remember
You're
Windows?
Getting better.
Do you remember Windows integrity levels from Vista? Kind of this Uber permission. Windows integrity levels. They even stick these things in a box. where they're running is low integrity, which means they're, you know, they can't do squat. Almost everything in your system is medium integrity. These guys live in a box that's in low integrity, and by default, processes that come out of that are low integrity. Nobody can make a low integrity process damage or modify a medium integrity. And that's the smallest stuff they do. It's a whole different animal. It truly is. Another way to think of it, a lot of modern apps are essentially glorified browsers. You know, if you look at Windows 8, if you ran something like news, what do you see in the task manager? WWA host. Is it still 2 and 10?
No.
I thought I didn't see it. But anyway, it's just they're really locked down little browsers.
Absolutely right. It's the same security model and isolation as Microsoft Edge uses and the same engine underneath. So that has no access to your documents unless you explicitly grant where to install an app, and that's all declarative. So there's no smoke and mirrors there. Gadgets was a whole different animal altogether.
All right. Thank you.
I promise the last one. I've had we have Premier support, and a few times we had called up. We had we didn't get Microsoft people. We got consultants, or I guess not Microsoft employees.
Is there something wrong with consultants, sir?
No. Other than they get paid by the hour, and it seems like the hours that they use to get their answer. But has anybody else had that similar situation where? Okay, so I'm not alone. This isn't really a Windows thing, but who here would love to have real Microsoft employees being their premier people that answering premier answers or premier questions or opening a case up with Microsoft and having?
Okay.
We pay a lot anyway. I mean, I think it works out to be like $600 an hour. So at $600 an hour, I mean, I'd love to have the person that needs to be on it right there.
Heike will give you her email.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Over on this side.
I have some questions around the start menu tiles in Windows 10. So I'll start with a question, provide two supporting examples, and then ask you the question again. So initially, I love the start menu tiles, but then it felt like Microsoft was telling IT that you can't manage that start menu anymore in Windows 10. We don't want you to. And had a case around that. To support that thought, in Windows 7, we had programmatic access to the start menu. If we deployed an application to our users, we could easily put that on the start menu. It was very, very convenient. You know, senior level management loved that feature. They could put that application front and center. I can't do that now in Windows 10. I can't script it at all. It's a huge pain in my rear. The second situation is, if I want to customize a start menu tile, you know, initially it seems like, oh, I can do that really well. But for example, my CIO said, hey, let's put the intranet on the start menu tile. And so what I discovered to create a custom icon for that is that the customization for the graphic has to be in the same directory as the executable for what you're calling. And therefore, I'm running iexplore.exe. So now I had to create this whole VBScript wrapper and create this whole structure just to get a different icon for my intranet on the start menu. And I'm like, this is way too hard. It looks great. But like the amount of work I had to go through to get that solution in place just seemed really hard to me. So I know that with 1607, there's some new improvements to the start menu. I know IT can control one part of it, and then the users can control the other part. But for me, that's still not where I need it to be, because now I'm forced to use group policy to control that. And so it further complicates it. If I've got users in admin and finance and HR, and we need to have different start menus, now I've got to have those users or those computer accounts or users accounts in a certain location in AD, depending on how you set up your group policy, to have that come down. So it just seems like the start menu, it's great, I love it, but man, from an IT enterprise perspective, so hard to manage it and get it to where my directors and my CIO want it to be. Is anybody else feeling that?
Hey, you're with us.
I'm not with you on this, and I hate it because, you know, it should be the easiest thing in the world to say there's a tile, here's a coordinate, you know, make sure these ones are, when we originally saw the export start layout and then import start, it's like, oh, that's wonderful. But there's some weird thing, there's a take that article about this, where it gets laid over to some folder, but it only works if you apply it before anyone logs into the system. There's no way to do it after the fact. It's just people like their start menus, and corporations like to set, lay out a standard one, you know. Mm. And it shouldn't be this hard. You know?
So,
I think that there's two aspects to it. There's the method of doing it, which clearly your feedback is valid, and you know we'll take that back and explore better ways to do it. And you know your guidance is helpful for us. The second part is when you can do it, and you can absolutely customize the start menu and the taskbar layout in Windows 10, and that's one of those features that I mentioned before are available from the enterprise and the EDU SKU. So the ability to centrally manage it is available in those SKUs. How you centrally manage it clearly is problematic for you, so we'll have to take a look to see how we can make that easier.
Well, when you use GPO, you can change it at any
point. It comes after GPO.
So it's just the default layout can only be configured before the user logs in. Yeah. And the capabilities that we've added so far, being able to specify a start screen layout, which wasn't possible in previous releases, and being able to configure the taskbar, are based on your feedback. We've been gathering that from customers, building up the evidence to say that we want to make those changes and presenting that to the Shell team for them to implement. The PM who's actually responsible for that was here doing a session this week. So if you went to the shared PC set up by school PC session, Tyler was the person that we worked to implement those capabilities. So we certainly are moving that direction, and we certainly want to look at other options for doing that as well. It's just we're incrementally adding those capabilities.
Where are we? Over here. Hi.
Hi. I have a user profile question, and just want to sort of give you one props that, you know, Windows 10 is a very elegant operating system and done a lot of innovation on the security and protecting us as far as like anything changing and the Defender providing that offline scanning to actually look for that rootkit, and that is really an awesome perspective of what we're doing. But from a user profile getting corrupted, and there was like, you know, that sort of behavior where your disk IOPS are at 95% or 99%, and opening up a support call, and the standard methodology to fix a corrupt user profile is to rename it and start a new profile, and then you're subjected to actually lose all your favorites, all your settings, all that investment of making your profile the way it was, the time to actually rebuild it back to that original state, and the amount of time that is now lost. Have we ever like figured out what is getting corrupted or what could be protected
We've fixed lots of issues related to that. Just out of curiosity, who's seen corrupt user profiles on Windows 10?
Who is using user profiles? First question.
Well, everyone uses user profiles when they log in. That's the next question. We'll get to that in a second.
Sorry.
Who's using Windows 10 and has seen corrupt user profiles? Okay, that's maybe 10-15%. Of those, how many of you are using roaming user profiles?
Okay. Only four hands.
That was maybe half of them. For those using roaming user profiles, I would have to ask why.
Yeah.
A lot of the issues that we see include roaming user profiles as a piece of that. So we want to move away from that, and there's some sessions here. There was one done by Dave Falkus and Steve, who's drawing a blank on the name at the moment, but they did a session on using UEV and AppV and work folders and OneDrive for Business and enterprise state roaming and all these other technologies that we have to achieve the same thing without all the downsides of roaming user profiles. Roaming user profiles are awful if you're on slow network connections, across WAN links, typically connecting in via VPN. So there's lots of downsides to them, including the potential for corrupting them as they get copied to and from servers. The other issue is that as we release new feature updates, those new feature updates change the profile version. So your roaming user profiles aren't compatible between versions of the OS. So you start to have to deal with those types of issues as well, especially for people who deal with multiple PCs at once running different versions of the OS. That gets thoroughly confusing. So moving away from roaming profile should be a goal. The corruption issues, those are a little concerning. Definitely open up support cases for those to investigate.
Yep.
Don't accept the answer that, just delete it and recreate it. Try to get to a true root cause.
I mean, it seems like there's some kind of need for a migration of, there is an existing corrupt profile. Is there anything to recover from that data to actually transfer to loot, to sort of gain that time with, in that, you know, that was
invested? And certainly that can be done for portions of the user profile. Like favorites are not that hard to migrate from one profile to another. My documents obviously are pretty easy to migrate from one profile to another. So you can salvage portions of the user profile.
Right.
But still, deleting the user profile and recreating it from scratch should be a last resort.
Yeah. Thank you.
We're just under 15 minutes to go, so please, if we could move this along, everybody get their questions answered. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I would like to ask you if there is some easy way how to stop Windows to talking outside of our network. I am talking especially about telemetry, but there are some other applications inside Windows, especially Cortana or any other universal apps that are trying to connect outside the network.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a white paper on TechNet right now that talks about that. I think it's managing connections. I don't remember what it's called. Here's a simple way to do it. How many of you are familiar with the Trust Center, the Microsoft Trust Center webpage? So if you go to the Microsoft Trust Center, there is a, on the main page, so all you have to do is microsoft.com/trustcenter, and it lists, like, on the bottom half below the fold, so to speak, a bunch of products, and there's one that's, they just changed it. I don't know why they did it. They didn't ask me, but there used to be a blue box that said click here for Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016. Now it just says Windows Server 2016. I have to talk with those guys because it's not just about them. But anyways, if you click on the Windows Server 2016, it will bring up a landing page that talks about privacy and telemetry. And so there's like a description of what telemetry is and what it's not, a bunch of white papers. In the white paper section, there's one specifically around managing connections back to Microsoft or something like that. When you see it, you'll know. If you don't see it...
I know this article.
Okay. So that article complete. That article goes through a bunch of registry settings that will discuss, you know, you can turn this off by doing this, turn this off, doing that. We're actually in the process, we'll be updating that, and we'll have group policy baselines that will allow you to do that much easier. That's coming very soon.
Yeah.
Now,
we've had a lot of internal efforts around that too, just to identify ourselves. What is all that stuff?
Yeah.
Zero
because,
exhaust efforts
side,
to figure
that
out.
The side effect of this is that is have some performance impact to the user environment, to the user desktop click performance or something like that.
I don't think it should affect performance. It may break a bunch of stuff. And so, you know, when you're turning off things, you're turning off things. And so that's why we document granularly, like if you want to turn off Cortana, you know, or block Cortana's traffic, here's what you do for this. And, you know, the baseline policies will do something very similar to do that, but I would use them very wisely. It's not something that I would overmarket, so to speak, because, you know, if you want to turn it off, here's the way to turn off. So that will be coming soon, and it will actually be referenced within that white paper.
Bear in mind also that if you do turn the telemetry entirely off, you lose all your Windows Update for Business settings. They don't work anymore. So that's a thing to keep be aware of. You know, if you stick it to zero, only enterprise guys can stick it to zero. But if you do that, the Windows Update for Business settings just stop.
Yeah.
Well, mildly
by design, yeah.
Yeah. In order to collect the Windows Update for Business settings, we need at least basic.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm just stating it's a fact. That's all.
Next question.
Okay, not so much an enterprise-focused question, but I've been personally asked this by two members of my family, and I think it was true in Windows 8 also. So, out-of-box experience, being able to sign in with your Microsoft account, very convenient, makes a lot of getting your new PC set up a lot easier. Why in the world does your user data folder get truncated to the first 5 characters when you sign in for a new user profile with a Microsoft account? Because that creates
most users
so much confusion.
They don't care because they don't see it. When you look in Explorer, it's going to show the full name. It's not going to show the truncated name. You really have to dig into the profile folder yourself. So if you go to C:\users, you'll see the truncated name, but otherwise it's the
longer
name.
I think it's actually been noted in both cases. I think it was noticed from the command prompt. They launched the command prompt and they saw, hey, why is my name missing the last two characters
of it?
The standard file dialogs
and Explorer and other things, they all show you the friendly name for the account, not that truncated name.
Okay.
It's really just picking a unique name to make sure that, especially within families, you have a tendency to have collisions between the names that are being used on the account. So it's just picking a value that's unique. If you're particularly anal about it, which I've been known to do at times, you can actually create a local account with the name that you want it to use as the folder, and then add the MSA to it, and then you'll have the original folder name.
Yeah, so if somebody wants to fix it after having made the mistake, though, essentially their only solution that I've seen, unless they want to go hack the registry or something, is to delete it, create
delete
a local
the user,
account,
and then create a user again.
I've been known to do that before, which is why my PC will say C:\users\Michael.
So if you could take everything before the at sign in the email address for the Microsoft account, though, I think that's a much more user-friendly, readable, sensible, but potentially
the,
also
the logic
unique.
That it's using right now is to not use that long of a name.
Okay.
It's using an 8+3 name. For legacy reasons, but
thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Over here.
Hey,
we're at 9 minutes.
We've heard a lot about all the new features that are coming into Windows Security, and also Emmet's kind of going away. It's no longer really supported. There might not be a new version, and a lot of the security that was in Emmet has been brought into Windows 10 by default, which is amazing. But currently, there's no substitute for attack surface reduction, where you can start blocking specific DLLs and OCX files being loaded into specific processes. Is there any plans potentially to pull that into a future release?
I think in most cases what we're approaching to do, for example, a lot of the ASR functionality, which is used for things like blocking, say, VML and Internet Explorer, our solution there is to move to something like Edge, which is standards-based and has a reduced attack profile. I realize there may be some other components.
Yeah, we use it in Office quite a lot.
Yeah, there are some workarounds there that are not great. In the next versions of Windows, we're looking at some of those final non, let's say, mitigation features, but are more granular management and how we can kind of replicate those for users. So it's that part of the Emmet package is well understood, and I understand there's a lot of enterprises out there that love it, and so we are actually actively looking at how to transport that into a future version of Windows.
Thank you.
Thanks. Next. Hi.
Hi. I had some questions about the Bash feature and the anniversary update. I have some developers I'm converting that are using OpenStack instances, and they really love the Bash features. So is that going to become a production feature sometime in the near future? So right now they want to use Bash but not have to commit to the Insider program to get updates to it. Mm. And the second piece they're looking for is tabbed Bash shell instances, so they don't have to install a third-party piece of software.
I mean, the Bash components are included in the anniversary update, so Windows 10 1607 includes the Bash components. They're just still listed as beta because they're still a work in progress. So they can use them now. I would expect that at some point they'll remove the beta tag and have an update to that that's now a fully supported release.
This is an official statement, but we've heard tons and tons of people love that feature. Mm-hmm. My understanding is they're seriously considering making it more mainline across the board. So, for example, it's only enabled in developer mode today. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Again, this is not official, but I know that there are a lot of considerations about how to basically integrate that into the experience in the future.
Yeah, it's gaining popularity very fast.
Yep.
That's cool to know.
Thank you.
Yeah. The interesting thing to implement that, they had to add support for long file names, which is really cool. It's not universal throughout Windows yet, but it does enable developers to use longer paths, much longer than 255 or 253 characters.
So if your user, if your people in your family are developers,
help them set up Bash.
There you go.
I forgot, on the console front, I'm actually part of the console geeks alias. It's called ConFans internally. And so you would. It's remarkable how many people are passionate about consoles and talk about it all day. But what I will say is I haven't seen tabs on the official roadmap, but again, that's something that's popular in things like ConEmu, et cetera, and it's being highly considered. And I know Paul Campbell, I'll give him a shout out, one of the core developers on there, I know he's considering that kind of stuff. So again, that's a great piece of feedback. I'll pass it on, but there are a lot of people who are passionate about getting parity between things like ConEmu and the internal client.
And don't you kind of expect to see any Linux-y thing called beta forever? You know, it's like they all get to like, no, you know, all every great piece of wonderful open source software is 0.9, you know. But you know what happens with every open source project? Eventually the guy who creates it gets a girlfriend or a job, and then it's just...
But never both.
Yes.
Another question.
We over here?
I understand that REFS was based on CFS. CFS came with the ability to create snapshots with your name that you wanted, modify them, delete them, and stuff. Could you consider adding that to Windows?
That's a deep one.
Do we have a storage guy here?
Anyone know storage well enough to even comment?
Yeah. It's like file systems is like a geek place inside of storage, too, right? So, yeah. I certainly don't.
You know, here's what I can tell you. They've been leaking out REFS slowly for a very long time. All the messaging is really, really interesting stuff, just really, really cool stuff. But they're just moving so slowly. I mean, I can't wait. I want my C drive to be REFS on my Windows 10 box, but that ain't going to happen for a while, you know? But it's a little like, remember when NTFS came out? You know, when NTFS first came out, it dribbled out very slowly, and most of the world was FAT32 until, what, NT4 or something like that, you know? So I think that's always been my guess, that whatever you're saying is probably going to happen, but it's all
I'm still waiting for the file system in Cairo to come out.
Yes, WinFS.
Well, I don't think it'll happen until people know they can ask for it. I mean,
exactly. And that's why user voice. I mean, seriously, okay. Send it to that, and the right folks will take a look at that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Is Windows Mobile dead?
Windows Mobile dead.
He's sitting with us here.
No. It's not dead. It's just
he's
resting.
He's looking quite old.
Did he pay you to ask that?
Right for the fjords.
And he's using a Windows phone. Look.
Yeah, no. I have a new HP phone here. So its demise has been greatly exaggerated. Let's put it that way. If you look at my session we did on Tuesday morning together with Jason Whitehorn, we actually demoed the next version of Windows Mobile or the next some new features of the next version, like windowed applications when you're using Continuum, etc. Right? So we are heavily investing in the mobile thing, and we are also investing in our ecosystem partners to bring new devices to market, etc. So we'll continue on that path as such.
If you haven't played with Continuum, you got it. It's amazing. You know. Over there? No, somebody over here. Hi.
Hi.
Our last questioner.
No strictly a Windows 10 specific question, but since we've run out of Windows 10 questions, that's what I'll ask anyway. You guys brought in UpV client into the anniversary update, thank you very much, into the actual product SKU itself. Are we likely to see the MDM deployment of the UpV applications through Configuration Manager and Engine?
I don't know the answer to that. I know it's an obvious question to ask, and we're exploring that. So again, great feedback. I'm not in the Intune and Config Man team, so I'm not quite sure what their roadmap is for that, but it would be logical.
Cool. We'd love to see it, by the way.
Excellent. Great.
Thank you.
Well, we got about 2 minutes. Is that another interlocutor? Yes, please.
Yeah, quick question. Do you know when OpenSSH will be natively supported in Windows?
Open what?
OpenSSH? I believe it's being worked on by the PowerShell team, so... unfortunately, they're not represented in here at the moment, but track Mr. Snover down. He will answer that question for you.
Thanks. Well, is that the guy with there? The toad feet?
Want to answer a question about drivers?
It sounds like a long question.
Okay.
We've only got a minute 40.
Okay, so in Windows 10, I noticed there's a new PowerShell commandlet, export Windows driver, which pulls a Windows drivers file out of the driver store in a running system. Would it be considered supported to pull the drivers out of a new computer and incorporate them into a driver package for an OSD solution?
Mostly. I mean, when you export a driver, you're exporting what is in the Windows driver store, which is what Windows Plug and Play would install. So the driver itself is fine. The only question is, what else is needed for that particular driver to fully function? Okay. So if the device needs a separate application to function, you might still need to install that separate application.
Okay, cool. Thanks for answering.
Wow. All right. So just a few things before we go. First of all, did you have a good time? Yes. Okay. If you... You know, if you like, we did this last year, and we did this year, and if you like this stuff, please do an evaluation, because that's the kind of feedback. Everybody reads that stuff very, very carefully. Some of us obsess over it. And so please do that. Windows team, thank you so much for letting me do this. You're all very kind.
Special thank you to Mark.
You guys are great. Yeah. You guys are great. So have a great last day at Ignite. Remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.